Education Committee to order. Thank you. And Senator Stumpf, we're going to take number three on the agenda first because of the great distances of the witnesses and allow them to get home. So, Senator Stumpf, if you would present your bill, and I think he's asked Senator Carlson to join him. He has an amendment to his bill on the same topic, essentially.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
thank you, Senator Stumpf.
We also have some guests and the superintendent from Lancaster, and we appreciate very much that you allow us to go first because it's it's a drive of about 6 to 8 hours to get back home.
Senator Stumpf, I remember having breakfast at the cafe at Lancaster when I was up in Kitson County for the prairie grass, whatever that seminar was that I went to a couple of times. So
there's not many chairmen that have actually been up in Kitson County, so thank you for going up there. Madam Chair, Senate File 350 is a piece of legislation that was the result of a school closing that occurred in Kitson County, a different school that closed, elementary school, and the impact it had on Lancaster was that when they closed that school, it actually triggered the loss of sparsity revenue in Lancaster. And it seems like it's kind of an odd thing. And the bill itself, we were going to have Senator Carlson join us. Senator Carlson has an amendment, or I have an amendment for Senator Carlson that relates to another small school. In greater Minnesota, and especially in the far northern part of the state, a lot of these small schools go through tremendous turmoil when they close a school. In the case of Lancaster and the Kennedy School that closed, what happened is that when Kennedy School closed, it basically was the loss of about $100,000 for Lancaster. Now, I think many of you would say, well, $100,000 is really not very much money. But let me ask the superintendent or the school board chair to just address what that means in their budget.
If I might, Madam Chair,
yes.
Senator. $100,000 for us.
Give your name.
My name is Brad Homestead. I'm superintendent of schools at Lancaster.
Thank you.
Yep. $100,000 is a big number for us. It's a little more than 4% of our total operating budget. So this is major for us. We have a budget of a little less than $2.5 million. So this is a big deal for the citizens of Lancaster.
Thank you, Superintendent. Mr. Homestead? Homestead. Thank you. And you wish to speak as well?
Madam Chair, Julie Shostrand.
Thank you, Ms. Shostrand.
To make a long story as short as possible, a few years ago, a neighboring school consolidated past a building referendum that allowed them to close the elementary school in one town and move those students into their remodeled high school building in a town closer to Lancaster. This action resulted in our district losing 100% of our elementary sparsity aid. We talked to Tom Melcher, Director of Program Finance for the Minnesota Department of Education, and neither he nor anyone on his staff could ever recall a situation like ours, where the actions of one school district would have such a negative financial impact on another school district. 3 years ago, after testifying at hearings in the House and Senate, our district was awarded $100,000 a year in transition aid, but for 3 years, and that runs out after this year. This bill is extremely important to the Lancaster School District, and we are asking to be held harmless once again. We are not asking for any new money. Rather, we are asking you to support Senate File 350 and funding that is currently in law. If we lose this aid, it will do irreparable damage to our fund balance. Lancaster Public School is not your average rural Minnesota school. This is a great school in every sense of the word. Our graduation rate exceeds 95%, and our attendance rate exceeds 96%. Our school has received numerous state and national awards and recognition. Not only did our school make AYP, we were ranked by schooldigger.com, which is a national web-based program used by parents to compare schools based on test scores. We were ranked as the number one elementary school in the state. We received the Minnesota Senate Award for Excellence in Education. We received the Governor's Fit School Award, and we were notified by U.S. News and World Report that we were identified as being one of the very best high schools in the United States. In fact, we were in the top 6% nationally. Criteria for these awards include district curriculum, classroom activities, college readiness of graduates, and MCA test results for all students, including all special populations. Our local taxpayers have already dug deep. Currently, we have two referendums on the books. Together, they total $2,700 per pupil unit, one of the highest in the state. In addition, 53% of our families qualify for free or reduced meals, and to be honest, I really don't know if our citizens have anything left to give. We live in a sparsely populated area of the state. Our county's sparsity is only 4.8 people per square mile. Our enrollment area is 456 square miles, and we bus an area closer to 1,000 square miles. Our five regular bus routes travel almost 500 miles per day. If our school did not exist, students on our eastern boundary would have three-hour bus rides daily, and that's unacceptable. They really don't have anywhere else to go. This really is a huge part of our budget. We are a highly qualified school, and we have already made cuts. Our local taxpayers have dug deep. We aren't asking for new dollars, but please don't take away funding that our district desperately needs and keep our funding at the current level. This is a unique situation, but one with devastating consequences for our school district, and as such, please hold us harmless. Thank you for your consideration of Senate File 350.
Thank you. Senator Hinn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Stumpf, or one of the other witnesses, what is the, I think the enrollment is pretty low, is it 168 or something like that? And what is the per pupil funding for the school district?
You mean, Senator, in addition to the basic formula?
Madam Chair, I guess what I'm looking at is if you take all the revenue sources that come into the school district, what is the per pupil funding amount that the school district operates on?
Senator Homestead.
Madam Chair, I believe that would be close to $8,000 with everything added into it.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, the sparsity dollars, and I understand that you've been, I don't know if victimized is the right word, but you've been affected by a change in another school, another district's location, which has affected the boundary. I think it's 19 miles or something, and so now you don't qualify. What is the money from the sparsity formula? What is that used for? What is the purpose of that funding?
Superintendent Homestead?
Madam Chair, Senator, that money just goes for basic operations. We ran in the red last year. We're having a hard time, just keeping our fund balance where it's at right now. So anything that we received in the former transitionator sparsity just goes right back into basic operations of the school district.
Some kind of interference here, but Madam Chair, just and maybe Mr. Nauman can help us, but or maybe even Senator Stumpf, you probably know, but the formula for sparsity that was put in place for particular purpose, I think, but I don't recall what that. Do you recall what that purpose was,
Senator Stump?
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, as they tried to address the sparsity costs of a district, especially in transportation, I think is an huge item, and I know a number of the schools in the northern part of the state spend way more on transportation than they, let's say, other school districts where there are more populous areas. So if you take, and I think you mentioned how many square miles is the district? 456 square miles. The transportation formula doesn't cover the cost of picking these students up. And if you go east to the next school district east is probably Badger or Roseau, and those are, there virtually aren't any roads between the two. You'd have to go all the way down south and then back up on Highway 32. And so it's not really feasible. So, they're kind of locked in an area. And, so I'd say the sparsity formula or the sparsity dollars are basically used to cover the extra costs of being sparse, transportation.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Hand.
And Senator Stump, I appreciate that. Mr. Nauman was reminding me there are two sparsity formulas. There's a transportation sparsity and, a regular sparsity formula. Is this intended to replace both of those, or do you still qualify for one of those, or has the change in the school district eliminated your qualification of both those formulas?
Superintendent Homestead.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Hand. Right now, we currently receive sparsity in our high school.
Okay.
We receive transportation sparsity. What we lost was all of our elementary sparsity.
And Madam Chair, one last question. How many enrolled elementary kid students do you have in the school?
Superintendent Homestead.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand. 168, I believe, as of today.
That's total enrollment.
I'm sorry, what?
Elementary.
Oh, elementary?
Yes.
79.
79. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Brana.
Madam Chair, I think this is important for the committee to talk about because these are the challenges that we face in greater Minnesota, and your ability to have outstanding academic achievement is something that we all should celebrate, and I actually would like us at some other time to understand how you got there, what it is that you do, what's your secret that you've managed to achieve those results with, free and reduced lunch and students, and so I think that's very important. Yet we do have this question about how do we pay for all of the school districts all over the state when we have, these kinds of very small and expensive schools, because there are those fixed costs, which, if you had 500 more students, it would be cheaper and you could have the same output, but you don't have those students. And I bring that up because that is why I have continued to advocate for exploring a greater use of shared services on the business side of things, because if that way you can keep your schools, which are the heart and soul of your community, but if we could on a more formal basis find ways to help you deliver the business side, and I know in Greater Minnesota you have done a great job doing that to this point, but I think there's more we could do. So I think it's incumbent upon us to work with you in partnership to figure out how we can lower the fixed costs so that you can continue to thrive and do what you do best. And so I have offered in the past, and I'm going to continue to be offering ideas about how, on a regional basis, we can take the business services out of the individual school districts so that you can lower your overall cost. But in the meantime, I support this approach. Thank you.
So we do have a full agenda. I would like to, Senator Stump, why don't you offer the amendment? Let's get that one on the table. We will be laying this over for inclusion inclusion in the omnibus bill. So there, if there's further clarification, we can get that. But that's the plan here.
Madam Chair, the amendment I would like to offer is the 350A-1. And Senator Carlson is here. There is a fiscal note to the current bill. There is not a fiscal note for this one, but that'll give us some time to get the fiscal note, and so that you'll have that Senator Carlson can probably explain what's happening with this one.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Senator John Carlson, Senate District 4, and I surely appreciate Senator Stumpf's willingness to allow our school district, in my district, to add on to the bill. This is for the Northland Community School. It comprises two communities, Reamer and Longville. And for a long time, once those two schools combined into Northland School, you can imagine some of the theater that goes on between these two neighboring towns. The high school has been located in Reamer, and there was an elementary school in Longville. The enrollment in Longville, the school at Longville was elementary only, and the enrollment had gotten down to about 60 students in the Longville Elementary School. And it was just absolutely no longer feasible to continue to operate that school financially. It was just not fiscally sound to do that. The problem was there was three school board members from Reamer, and there was school board members from Longville. There was four. One of them was a businessman and basically was told if he didn't vote to keep that school in Longville, his business was going to be boycotted. So he resigned from the school board. And so if you can imagine how local politics are. And so that left three and three. And so now the board was deadlocked on being able to close the school in Longville. As this process went on, there was also some instability if I'm not mistaken, in the superintendent's office. Trying to make that just a little bit shorter, finally, on May 20th of 2010, they did get another school board member that was evidently agreeable to closing the school. The school was closed officially. A letter was sent the next day, May 21st, to the Commissioner of Education, Commissioner Segrin, I believe it was at that time. A letter promptly came back saying thank you for your request. However, the deadline was May 1st. A 20-day problem in the school district created the inability of the Northland School to continue to receive the sparsity aid for the closed school in Longville. I hope that wasn't too long.
Yes, I think we get the picture. If there's no discussion, can we take a vote on that amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment to Senate File 350, signify by saying aye.
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 The motion prevails. Senator Stumpf, if there's no more discussion, we will lay this on the table for consideration for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I'm sure. Can I?
Just
want to make one comment, and I appreciate your being here today, Senator Stumpf, and Superintendent. I've been working on some other things for another bill I'm working on, and it gives me information about third grade reading proficiency, and so I just looked up your school district out of curiosity, and your reading proficiency, according to this, you've got more than 90% of your third graders at proficiency, which is pretty good. So congratulations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're very proud of Lancaster. So.
Thank you, Senator Hannon, that's close to my heart, is the proficiency by third grade. So I hope we can clone what you're doing and get that word out to others, because one of the things that you talked about, and there was reference that Senator Bonhoeff made about free and reduced price lunch, just because they're on free and reduced price lunch doesn't mean they can't learn and that they can't, or that they can't learn to read. So
right.
Bless your hearts for all you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And only 8% of my proficiency. That's pretty good.
Senator Rest, I think he's been patiently waiting.
Compensatory reading proficiency.
Is that graduation rate?
No.
Senator Rest, welcome to the committee.
Okay.
You have Senate File 199.
I brought the wrong folder. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you very much for hearing Senate File 199. I appreciate the courtesy. It is a bill that was brought to my attention from one of the school districts that I represent, but is also an issue that's important to other school districts that encounter the same situation with out-of-state students who are sent to Minnesota for and sent to residential facilities that are in Minnesota. And currently the receiving school district, or where the school district in which the facility is located, is responsible for providing the educational services to that student without reimbursement or being counted by the state with regard to the general fund revenue. And what this bill does is to take away the requirement that a school district do that without charge, except for those students that come with an IEP and that would otherwise receive those services. This has been quite a problem and issue in 281, and it's also Robbinsdale School, and also for the St. Paul School District in particular. It does provide an increasing burden on our school districts to provide those educational services, and currently the school district's ability to charge tuition for those students is very limited, and this bill would allow that to happen. There's no general fund impact at all. It is just giving school districts who do provide those services some flexibility to either charge parents in other states whose children are being sent here, and or the sending state. It does not apply at all to those students that have, again, who have IEPs and are here for special needs children, and it does not apply to homeless students who are indeed counted in a school district's responsibility for their providing educational services.
Senator Rest, to clarify that point, it looks as if the district does not have an obligation unless that student, when attempting to be served, already has a tuition arrangement or agreement to pay that cost. In other words, it appears that this isn't a burden of the school district to try to get that or recapture it. It needs to be arranged by whoever is attempting to enroll the student and be served by the school district. That correct?
That's correct. And currently that is that's fairly ambiguous, or sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And I have Mr. John Newman and Mary Gilbert. Mr. Newman is from District 281, and Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul School District, just to give a bit more detail of the impact on our school districts, and particularly when we're in tight budget times.
Very good. Who would like to go first? Mr. Newman.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Newman, and I'm one of the teaching and learning specialists in Robbinsdale Area Schools. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate File Number 199, which would clarify the obligations of Minnesota school districts to provide educational services to students without disabilities who are not residents of Minnesota. As a district, we currently provide educational services for students that receive care and treatment at facilities located within our district. We've maintained a positive collaborative relationship with our partners through the years as we address the challenges that we face when students come into these facilities. One of our partners is the Hazleton Center for Youth and Families, a name that's widely recognized and well-respected. The center provides residential care and treatment services for young people who come from all over the country and even from outside the United States. So far this year, we've had students that have participated in our school program from 20 different states, as well as for countries around the world, including a student who just came from Europe today when I called to check on that. This center provides residential care and treatment services for young people who come from all over the country, and students who reside at Hazleton may spend anywhere from a week to 120 days receiving treatment for substance abuse. During a student stay at Hazleton, the student is scheduled into 2 hours of instructional time with a teacher provided by our school district. The per pupil costs associated with providing that teacher are covered for students who are residents of Minnesota. However, current state funding makes no provision to cover the costs for educating out-of-state or out-of-country students who reside at a care and treatment facility located in Minnesota. In addition, attempts to recover educational expenses from districts or state agencies outside of Minnesota have not generally been successful, nor have attempts to receive payment directly from the families of these children for the educational services. One option to cover the educational costs for out-of-state and out-of-country students would be to enter into a tuition agreement with the facility itself. If, for example, Hazleton were to include the cost of educational services along with its other charges when parents are billed, our district could get paid directly by Hazleton for providing educational services to out-of-state and out-of-country students. However, Hazleton has not been interested in this arrangement. And because our district is required to provide educational services to all students, including out-of-state and out-of-country students, Hazleton feels that our district should be responsible for all expenses. If the bill before you now were enacted, a facility like Hazleton would know that out-of-state and out-of-country students without disabilities would not be guaranteed educational services unless, as Part 3 of the bill states, there were, quote, a tuition arrangement or agreement to pay the cost of education from the placing authority. As a district, then, we would look to Hazleton for direct payment of these educational services for out-of-state and out-of-country students. We place a high value on educating all students within the district, but question whether the cost for serving students without disabilities who are not Minnesota residents should be at the expense of services to Minnesota and specifically Robbinsdale students. Therefore, our district endorses the bill before you now and appreciates your consideration of this amendment. Hopefully, we'll see it in the final education package when you're finished with all your hard work this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools. This issue actually came up last session. It's actually come up multiple times in my career at St. Paul. And I think it's one of kind of a fundamental unfairness because Minnesota, we pay all the other states when students get placed in residential or other care facilities. In fact, we spent almost $400,000 in tuition payments to other states last year. We also make close to a couple million dollars worth of payments. If our student, a St. Paul student, gets placed in a residential facility in another district, we also pay that other district for the care that they provide when our students, you know, are receiving educational services. Under our current situation, we have to bill the local school district if we have Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, a student that's in a facility, they simply don't pay. And then we get a portion of the coverage for that teacher through the special education formula, but that's not even half of what our cost is. And so I don't think it would be quite such a bitter pill to swallow for us if we weren't diligently writing our checks to other states, you know, when we get billed from them. And so, you know, I mean, I think this is not the only area that it surfaces with some of our neighboring states. You know, the tuition arrangement with Wisconsin. Wisconsin seems to be, you know, one of the bigger offenders for us, obviously because of the location that we are, you know, with kids coming into treatment facilities from Hudson and Prescott and New Richmond, you know, and the like. But it's not just Wisconsin. I mean, there are some places in Iowa and even Dickinson, North Dakota. So anyway, we've asked the commissioners in the past to talk to our fellow commissioners about having some kind of an arrangement. We also wondered maybe if they could deduct, you know, maybe have a system where it would be deduct, you know, if we take in students versus them, that there could be some kind of netting out of the costs at the end of the year. But frankly, there really is no incentive under the current law for the facilities to try and get the parents to get a tuition arrangement like we do for our kids when we go out of state and pay. So this would actually provide a little more incentive for the facilities that are taking in these kids, to actually work with the families to get their local school district to develop a tuition arrangement, which they should be doing in the first place.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Senator Rest, any closing comment? Any discussion or questions?
Madam Chair, I think that the two testifiers have put the situation quite clearly and the dilemma that local school districts are find themselves in, and I don't think that this is an unreasonable policy position for Minnesota to have.
Senator Tag.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think that someone said, maybe Ms. Gilbert, that this had been come up before. This issue has come up before, and I'm just wondering why. I mean,
I don't think
there's a dollar figure attached, a cost to the state, so
there's
I'm
no
wondering
cost.
Why we didn't do it.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, certainly I had the bill last year as well, and it was an issue in the House. And I'm not sure whether it was ever included in a bill, but it may have been one of those bills that then did not get passed last year.
Now, Senator Rest, we ended up with nothing at the end, so it's
exactly.
It's laying with the rest of the
I
folks.
I was trying to be
Senator Scheid. Madam Chair, was it in the Senate bill? I just don't.
I don't remember.
Okay. I don't remember, but let's.
Okay. That's all right.
If your questions are answered, I'd like to lay this on the table for possible inclusion in
thank
the
you very
omnibus
much.
Bill this year.
Attention.
You bet. Thank you very much for coming and telling the story. Senator Rosen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, it's nice to be in front of your committee and in front of this great group of people here. And if I could just say happy birthday to Senator Nienau today.
thank you for revealing.
He's 25, that. I think, or something like that.
I hope he did.
Ted, you're on.
There's the cake.
We won't sing right now. We'll wait for the cake.
And
yes,
the treats are coming.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 250 is the qualified economic offer. And as you know, Madam Chair, and many members on this committee, it's been around for a while. I think Senator Neville worked on it, and perhaps you too, Madam Chair. But it is it's a very good bill because during the negotiation process with employee groups at the school, it allows the school board to have an option or under its own discretion to implement this QEO. And before I do get started, there is a handout in your pamphlet, too. And basically, when it is implemented, and this is an option, the employees could not strike over financial issues. But I want to be very clear that this is not a salary freeze, okay? The negotiations over the increase in total compensation are complete at a level equal to the increase in the revenue from the basic formula allowance multiplied by the district's enrollment. So that's how they come up with this set amount that cannot be negotiated above and beyond. So when you look at the formula allowance in previous biennium, times the enrollment, the increase in the total revenue is what is offered to trigger the QEO. Madam Chair, I do have an amendment that would straighten things up.
Yes. Okay. Could we have someone offer the delete all amendment, the A3, to put the bill in the form? Yeah. Would appreciate Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I'll offer
birthday
the
birthday boy. We'll do that.
Offer the A3 amendment.
Okay. All in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same thing. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the A3 amendment, basically, number one, as I said, it sets up the formula. But it also, from going from to include the increase in the revenue, used to be 1 year. Now it's 2 years for the biennium. I think that's an important long-term look at what's going forward for the school district. And the language is just really clarified for this A3 amendment here. And as you know, when the school boards are negotiating, I have 14 different schools, 14 different superintendents, 14 different school boards in my Senate district. And if one crumbles and goes to, and there was some that settled for 10% increases, the pressure is extremely hard for all the other ones around to not settle for something that they absolutely can't afford. So that's why this is really important to look on it as a biennium, not just 1 year. It also expands the application of the QEO to all the employee groups, not just teachers, which is really important, because employee costs are about 80% of all district expenditures, and with teachers, they're accounting for about half or more than 80%. Each of the employee groups are treated separately, and so basically a school board would have the discretion to apply a QEO to one group of the employees but not the others. So basically it's not a one-size-fits-all. And the amendment also clarifies that other sources of revenue, the fund balances, for example, are not to be used to fund a settlement under the QEO. This will be done through the net increase provided by the increases in the basic formula allowance and the district enrollment. And Madam Chair, I have Mr. Bartholomew and Ms. Kelleher too with me.
Who wishes to go first?
Go ahead.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Thank you, Senator Rosen, for sponsoring the bill. We're asking for your support of Senate File 250 because it seems every year we hear announcements by school districts that they're going through another round of teacher layoffs and program cuts. And every time this happens, students are the ones that pay the price. One of the key reasons, as Senator Rosen outlined, for these regular announcements of teacher layoffs is school boards have been unable to keep their contract settlements in line with available revenues. In short, districts are agreeing to spend more than they have, and as a result, they have to cut teachers and programs to balance their budgets. We see Senate File 250, the qualified economic offer, as a critical option for school boards to keep their teachers and other employees. In essence, as Senator Rosen mentioned, the QEO allows a school board to say, we're willing to increase compensation by the same amount of increase that the district received from the state, but we don't want to spend more and then have to cut people. We're sure improvements can continue to be made in this bill as it moves along, and we're also open to a better strategy for at least limiting the number of teacher layoffs. But from our perspective, the current negotiation structure doesn't work, and students are suffering because of it. I'd like to anticipate some of the arguments you might hear against the QEO and Senate File 250 by offering the following. The first argument you might hear is the QEO eliminates local control over contract negotiations. This is simply not true. No one is required to use a QEO. In fact, there may well be school boards that choose to totally ignore it. Nothing will change for them, and that's fine. Even for those boards that choose to use the QEO, the expectation is they'll first negotiate in the same manner as they always have and would use the QEO only as a last resort. Yet the QEO is a local option, not a mandate. The second argument, wouldn't increased funding for schools be a better solution for preventing teacher layoffs? And a lot of the focus lately on layoffs has come from recent state and district deficits. Unfortunately, we've looked back at district contract settlements and state funding increase data covering 27 years, back to 1985. The data is from the green sheets from MSBA and the revenue increases from the department and legislative staff. And in 18 of those 27 years, district contract settlements exceeded the increases in the state formula. As another example, in 2004, the Minneapolis Star Tribune did an analysis of contract settlements and district funding. As part of that analysis, they found that from 1998 through 2003, 92 districts increased teacher pay over inflation while also making cuts in staff. It's fairly obvious that in good times or bad, when the state provides X in funding, school boards typically settle for X plus Y. The third argument, the QEO is a cap on salaries. I have two responses. The first, for those districts that choose to ignore the QEO, there's no impact. For boards that choose to use it, again, it's presumed they've gone through regular negotiations in good faith, and then only as a last resort had to use this. And there's nothing to say that once a board uses it, they'll ever use it again. I would like to put out the one caveat that as the bill is structured, if in the end, as Senator Rosen mentioned, the board and the employee group can come to no agreement by the January 15th deadline, the bill does specify that of the available funds, the first call on those funds will be to maintain and increase benefits, and what's left would go for salaries. Our second point is if a school board is faced with a choice of agreeing to a salary increase they can't afford or trying to provide smaller increases to preserve teacher jobs and programs, we'd argue that the smaller increases and keeping teachers is best for students. This is especially true if we're trying to retain younger teachers at a time when half our current teaching workforce is expected to retire over the next 10 years. We're not saying anyone is doing anything wrong under the current system, and we certainly aren't saying that teachers are paid too much. What we are saying is the current system doesn't work in the best interests of students or less senior teachers. I understand there are a lot of factors involved with these issues, and if there's a better way to give school boards the ability to balance contract costs with available revenues so that they can keep more teachers, then we're certainly interested. But the data clearly indicates that the current system is out of balance. And we'd like to thank Senator Rosen for offering to the Senate File 250, and we'd ask for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Ms. Kelleher?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And as we look at the Senate file, we want to thank Senator Rosen for her leadership on this, but also want to reinforce that this is a voluntary measure that local boards would use as just another tool in the toolbox going forward. But we feel we're heading into uncharted economic times, and we need tools that balance the bargaining table going forward to be a partner in the state as we continue to find how to do best for our students. My grandmother always used to say, you can't give what you don't have. And in the end, that's what this bill would allow us to do. We wouldn't be forced to come to an agreement over dollars that the state doesn't provide. And certainly, school board members, when faced with the threat of a strike, feel that the bargaining table presently is unbalanced. Certainly, when I had local board members here from Lakeville and Matamidi for Senate File 56, the reason we thought a two-year freeze really worked is that we go back in and change some of the present law. This is an attempt to balance the bargaining table in another form. It also encourages us and I believe our employees to come to more realistic cases. There are times I've heard in the past where school billiards are at zero and employees come in at 30% and they wage a community war. This would certainly say, come in with a reasonable offer, get your work done, and complete the agreement so we can get back to what we all care about, educating kids. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the author or the witnesses?
Are Madam Chair, you've got a lively group here.
Yeah. Well, you haven't put us to sleep. You're just, one I think has been, an explanation has been very good. Is there anybody here who would like to testify for or against the provision? I don't think we've had anybody sign up, but that doesn't mean that we won't allow that.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jody Poor with Education Minnesota. And we do not support Senator Rosen's bill. We believe it is well-intended. We're fortunate enough today some of our teachers are here for their respective lobby day, and so we're going to actually have the privilege of having one of our teachers speak to you about this issue as well. So to that end, I'm going to try and keep my comments brief to allow Julie an opportunity to speak to you as well. We believe that this bill is definitely about local control, and we've heard a lot about this legislative session about wanting to give more local control, and we think that this bill does not actually do that, but instead has a state legislated proposal to deal with local issues. During difficult economic times, every community, as we all know, is affected differently. And for that reason, we think that the discussions about how to deal with those issues should be dealt with within that framework, in that community. The current system, we believe, works. And quite frankly, it allows all voices of the parties affected to be at the table and to be heard. We do understand that this bill is permissive, as Senator Rosen pointed out, and the language includes, you know, if a school board chooses this. But if, in fact, they do, it's important to understand that that drastically changes the ability for the employees and the teachers to have a voice at the table any longer. If the school board says this is the decision that we're making, we're selecting this option, then the conversation is ended. And again, we believe that the discussion should take place at the local level, and this is not necessary. Lastly, Madam Chair and committee members, you know, we have also talked a lot about the fact that our kids are first. This session, I think, almost every committee meeting that I've been in, someone has pointed that out, and obviously our organization strongly supports that kids are first. I also want it to be on the record, acknowledged and remembered, that our educators put our kids first every day, and I haven't heard that a lot. I have heard that kids should be first, and we strongly support that. But let's please remember that our educators do that every single day, including when they're having discussions about the very issues that this bill addresses. So with that, Madam Chair, committee members, I would like to turn it over to our great and fine educator who's with us here today, Julie.
Introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Julie Seiler. I'm here today for Lobby Day. I'm a music teacher, and I've taught in our state for 20 years. I've taught all levels of band, currently teaching 5th through 8th grade band at Spring Lake Park Schools. I'm currently the member rights advocate for my school district, and I'm a member of the negotiation team. The current process of bargaining works. In my district, teachers have taken a pay freeze for the past 2 years, some for 4 years. The current process allows teachers a voice at the table and brings both sides to come together with reasonable offers. Our teachers put kids first every day, and many teachers are continuously pursuing classes and higher education degrees for this reason. As member rights advocate, many teachers come to me seeking advice on furthering their education. Some continue in spite of salary confines, but all teachers do so to make a better classroom for kids. Teachers value and recognize the importance of furthering their education because they know it helps the kids that they teach every day. Thank you for your time and allowing me to speak to you today.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the witnesses. In both of your testimony, you've testified that the bill is not needed because the system currently works. And my question is, works for who? Could you elaborate on that? You're saying that it works, but who does the current system benefit? Does it benefit the public? Does it benefit the students? Does it benefit employees. Who is the beneficiary of the current structure?
Ms. Bohr?
Madam Chair, Senator Han, I'll take that one and save our educator from having to respond to that unless she wants to. Senator Han, I think that the system works for all. As I stated, the current process allows both all voices to be heard in the discussions. And I believe that Julie mentioned in her testimony that she has seen firsthand in their district where the teachers have, in fact, taken freezes over the course of the last several years. And that's important to note, not simply that they have taken the freeze, Senator Han, but more importantly, that it demonstrates that they are aware of not only the economic times and the specific situations that the district is facing, but also because they know the needs of their kids as well as anyone. And I think we would be hard-pressed to try and say that they don't bring the needs of those kids with them when they go to the table and talk about these issues.
And Madam Chair, and I appreciate it. I also served on a school board and was on the negotiating team with our school district, and so I have been in negotiations over contract issues, and I've been in circumstances where we were negotiating a contract in the course of at the same time trying to pass an operating levy. In the midst of the negotiation, the operating levy failed, which then we wanted to go back and negotiate a contract to reflect the fact that we didn't have money, and we were not allowed to do that. We were not able to do that because of the current structure of negotiating, and the current structure in law, in state law, has, as Senator Rosen testified, created a situation in which it is very, very difficult for the elected representatives of a community to manage the cost. And I think what this bill is getting at, and I support the bill, is an attempt to try to create a structure that gives the elected representatives of the public an opportunity to manage the largest cost that they have. And I don't know that it serves the public or serves the students to have a school district go into a potential strike situation over compensation that school districts don't have, and be faced by, which we did in our school district, of allowing a contract to be settled that was beyond our capacity. We had to lay off 50 teachers as a result of the contract. And when we pointed that out in negotiations, the negotiating representative said, well, that's sort of the board's problem. So in my experience, I don't know that this system works that we have today. And your perspective may be different. I appreciate that. But I think that what we need to do is restore the local control of school district management by providing tools that allow elected local representatives to make decisions about how to manage money instead of having the legislature do that for you. And I don't think this is a usurpation of local control. I think it is a tool to enhance local control. So I appreciate your perspective, but in my experience, I don't think the system works very well if the idea is to be able to manage the financial resources of the school district at a local level.
Ms. Bohr, what are yours or your organization's ideas if a school district, I assume you haven't really challenged that this doesn't reflect the calculation that the money that is available. But if that money is not there, what are your organization's suggestions on how to how that should be resolved of in terms of continued negotiations? How do you negotiate, or what do you do if there isn't money there to provide? As you've heard some illustrations of that. What does your organization suggest, or do you believe that whatever you are able to obtain, it's not your problem about how to get the money?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think to say that the experience that you referenced, Senator Han, and to, you know, paint a broad brush of that would be inaccurate and I think unfair, teachers or negotiators come to the table with the mindset that we want whatever we can get, and However that ends up to you, board members, that's your problem. I don't think that that is typically the case. I think that we all know the economic times that we're in, Madam Chair, to your point specifically. And I think that some of the recent years, I don't have the data with me right now, but I think it's actually been presented in this committee, if not it has in the other education committees, I believe, about the freezes in the history of the settlements that have taken place over the past few years, which reflect that people that are at that table do, in fact, recognize the economic times. And in addition to the compensation piece alone, that also takes into account increases in, you know, health insurance. I don't want to delve into this, you know, the increase in contribution to pension. And I know we have, you know, varying views on those, but I do believe that they have been willing to step to the plate, take sacrifices as well, all because they do recognize their district as a whole, and specifically that the kids are impacted, as I stated before. And I believe they bring that mindset and that spirit to the table with them. And that's why I believe the current system works, and the January 15th, specifically regarding the strike issue that you mentioned earlier, Senator Han. You know, history shows over the course of the last 17 years there have only been 3 strikes, and those occurred at the time when the January 15th deadline was not, in fact, in place.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the author. Senator Rosen, when we heard the wage freeze bill, I wasn't quite sure how my districts felt about it, and it took some time to get that information back, and I actually did get word that my districts opposed it and that their Legislative Action Coalition came out formally and opposed it. This I haven't heard from my districts. I heard from Minnesota School Boards Association. I actually see Mr. Kroonquist there, who represents AMSD. I'm curious, the all of the various people who speak for school districts, where they stand on this.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, that's a very good question. And I can say there is, of course, Mr. Bartholomew and Ms. Kelleher supports it. And I always try to meet with all of the 14 school districts that I represent. And unfortunately, 100% of them are in declining enrollment situations, and they all support this because it is an optional tool that they have in their toolbox. I mean, when you're dealing with salaries and compensation and funding from the state, you only have so many factors available, and so you have to live within that realm. Now, I should say, too, Madam Chair, just to reiterate, you still can negotiate on work days, vacation days. There is still that ability to negotiate all those other factors. But when it comes to salary, this is an option for the school districts to say, this is the cap of how much we can give you. We would like to give you more, but we can't, because this is with the declining enrollment factors coming in, or your fixed costs that are arising, your utilities, your insurance, your transportation, they all have to factor that in. And the money's just going so far. So this is something that we have to allow them to use if need be. Now, I also have many school districts that are looking at a hard freeze next year because of those fixed costs. So I'm not saying that they're all going to use this, but they're very happy that this is an option because they hate the pressure that they feel from other school districts when one settles, and it's kind of a domino effect. And it's just disheartening when you hear about negotiations and the school board has to hire an attorney to get out of that mess. And that has happened many times in my school districts where they have had to hire an attorney to bring this together. And that's just, to me, a waste of money, total waste of money that should be going to the kids or going to some other area. So,
thank you. We've got a number of testifiers, and we've got another bill, let's keep moving. Senator DeKreif, so let's try not to repeat. I think we've heard the statements that have been made. Yes.
Madam Chair,
Senator DeKreif, we're making a list, so okay. You'll be added to it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I just want a point of clarification. The teacher, Julie, is that your name?
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned that the last 2 years you've voted to have a pay freeze at your school.
Yes.
Is that a hard freeze? Is that no steps, lanes, anything?
That was a soft freeze.
A soft freeze?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, that there is a difference. It's kind of a misnomer, a pay freeze, when it's not a hard freeze.
However, we do have, in our particular salary schedule, we have teachers that have gone without any kind of pay increase for 5 years. Some of the teachers that are getting ready to retire, they're at the same level they've been at the last 5 years.
Okay, let's, Senator Thompson, and I will remind, this is going to be laid on the table for further discussion and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, but keep, if you have...
In light of Senator DeKreif's question, I will pass. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for Ms. Boer. I think you said that you felt that this was not local control, and I'm just trying to make the connection between something that's voluntary and saying that it isn't local control, and I'm wondering if you can help clarify that for me.
Ms. DeBoer.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, the reality is that school boards can make these kinds of decisions now. So the local control, we believe, is being deferred in part because we're going to have a legislatively semi-mandate, I'll say, because it is permissive, or it's been referred to as a tool in the toolbox that's available. But it's also something that is legislatively going to pass, that's going to be there available to them, when in fact they are already having these discussions, working within the process today. And I think that part of this is also about entrusting, I believe it was Senator Hand saying, the people that we elect. And so if we are really going to talk about trusting the people that we elect into these positions, then I think it's important to do that very thing and allow them to have those discussion with the educators at the table or the negotiators.
Senator, just follow up, Madam Chair,
yes,
quickly.
But
so who's going to make that decision about whether or not to use this tool? Who would make the decision?
Senator Rosen?
School board? Madam Chair, yes, the school board would be...
The local
Senator
school
Nelson,
board would make the decision about whether or not they want to use this tool.
Right.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank
okay.
you.
Senator Torres-Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like to request a vote on this. Even for the inclusion, I would like to vote, and I would like to request a roll call.
Okay. Sorry.
And I need to do this because I understand the intent of offering solutions for administrative purposes, Senator Rosen. I understand your intention, and I believe that you have a good intention. What is problematic for me as a person who really supports teachers and wants to give a, I really want to give a message to teachers that these are tough times and that I believe that they really want to educate our kids. I really believe in that. And that requires that I give a message that teachers are equipped and empowered to do these negotiations at the local level. I believe in that very strongly. And in fact, I know that in many districts, they are doing this. They are talking about, you know, the new teachers that are being hired, they are going to lose their jobs because they don't have enough seniority. And so they are really trying to figure out what to do at the local level. I have heard, you know, I heard this in my district and other districts, and I think that they are doing the right thing. By making a decision here today at this level, I am telling my teachers today that they are not capable of doing this, that I am making the decision on their behalf because they don't know how to do this. And the situation is such today that we are not increasing funding. We're telling them, you know, we haven't increased funding for several bienniums now. And because of that, because we're not giving you the money, we're going to tell you how to administrate money that we're not giving you. You have less money, and you better administrate that little money that we are giving you the way we want to. And that's problematic for me. And I am not saying that that's your intent, Senator Rosen, but I'm just telling you what my teachers are telling me that. You are not giving us enough money to give to really educate our kids today. And on top of that, you are telling us now how to do administration, and that is not fair. So I want to leave that on the record. I want you to know that that is what I hear in my district.
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the author, and it follows up on Senator Nelson's point. Is I don't understand in your language, Senator Rosen, how it's optional. Because if there's a set amount of money that's given to a district, then it's imposed on the district that it's not an option. They can't strike for reasons. So I don't understand the word optional. Mr. Bartholomew used that districts could choose to use this, and I'm just not clear what that means.
Mr. Bartholomew?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Member Senator Sieben. The whole structure of this bill is set with the presumption that local employee groups and their school boards will continue to negotiate in good faith as they always have. And this does tie to Senator Torres's raised comments in the sense that, and in most cases, again, we're not implying anybody's doing anything wrong in the current system. So in most cases, everything's working just fine and there's not an issue. But there are those occasional circumstances, and again, we're not suggesting this is necessarily wrong, where the union is trying to get as large an increase in compensation for their members as possible, and that's
my question.
Totally appropriate. On the other hand, the school board is the management team, locally elected, to try to balance that interest in trying to get as much total compensation as one group can. The other group has to be there as a balance to say, we'd like to be able to do that, but we don't have the money to pay for it. And if we were to give you that, we're going to have to cut X number of positions to be able to afford it. So it's a local option. And we're presuming everybody's going to continue to negotiate in good faith. But somewhere along the line, the management side, and Ms. Kelleher talked about the implications of a strike for a school board. And I think one of the reasons, thankfully, Minnesota's had so few is because strikes are painful. Red Wing had a strike, 4 years ago? I still remember it very vividly. Strikes are not something you want to go through. And that, there's pressure on school boards to avoid those. And really, there's not much left for a school board other than to come as close as they can to where the other side wants to go without going too far. So this is an optional stopgap.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, I don't think that answered my question. And my point was really that if certain conditions are met, there's no option left, that the school board is telling the union you can't strike. So you keep using that this is somehow an option for districts to impose, but if they negotiate up to a level, then there's no option left. You're forcing that option off the table in contrary to what you're saying. But I understand we're coming at it from different perspectives, so perhaps you can.
If I might, we're going to honor the request of to have a roll call vote on it, but I would just like to ask kind of a rhetorical question at this point. If the one side of the bargaining unit has both the power to negotiate and to strike, on the employee side, what tools does the school board have? You don't even need to answer it. Just think about it.
Is there a motion?
Yep, Senator Torres.
Did you want to make the motion? You're making a motion that you would like a roll call vote on the motion to lay it on the table.
Correct.
Okay.
And
is that for possible inclusion?
For possible inclusion, yes. Yeah. Yes. I would like to do that.
Senator Bonnet.
Madam Chair, I had previously asked a question, and I was wondering if I could ask Mr. Kroonquist, who represents my district, to if he had a position or.
If we could do that quickly, we've got another bill, and.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you. Senator Kroonquist. Our Senator Kroonquist. Mr. Kroonquist, it's been a long day already.
I understand, Madam Chair. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff and members. My board actually doesn't have a position on this bill, but we do have an alternative that has been endorsed by my board. It's part of our legislative platform. We believe we should move to a system where we get rid of the January 15th deadline, have a much earlier deadline, like September 1st, and then if the two sides have not been able to reach an agreement through the collective bargaining process by that point, that both sides would be required to submit to binding arbitration.
Thank you.
So that would be our preference. But, again, we don't have a position on this legislation. We do appreciate Senator Rosen bringing it forward as part of the discussion.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray, would you like to restate the motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been told to reframe the motion because motion is to include this as for a possible inclusion. So I would like to amend that for a vote, and I want a roll call on not so that this is not included in the omnibus bill for not inclusion.
You move that this does not pass or to be included.
It should not be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Is that clear?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shade.
No, it isn't to me, really. I guess it's a matter of whether I vote yes for one or no for the other. I mean,
right.
The motion is that the original motion was that it be included. If I don't agree with that, I vote no.
Right. But I've been told
saying,
to.
So we'll withdraw the motion to include the bill in the omnibus bill, and you're voting that we not include this, or you're making a motion to not include this in the.
I have been advised to do so. I agree, Senator Scheid, that originally I thought if you vote no, obviously you are voting for not inclusion in the omnibus bill, but I have been told that I have to do a not inclusion, so. I am just being guided by the staff.
So you're voting not to include.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't mean
to vote affirmatively is for not including it in the omnibus bill. To vote negatively is to allow it to be considered for inclusion.
And then, Madam Chair, will there be a subsequent motion to include it?
Yes. We will lay it on the table for possible.
There's no vote on that.
We don't have to vote on that.
This is very strange.
They understand what we're doing.
Does everybody know what they're doing? Senator Stubb.
Madam Chair, I was hesitant to ask questions because I have the other bill that people are here for, and I'm not sure if we're going to run out of time.
We're going to take it up.
Will there be an opportunity to look at the actual content of this bill apart from some of the general parameters? Because it seems like under what you term as total compensation, it would seem to me that some things probably should not really be in there. For example, if someone has a job teaching driver's training in the summertime, and usually the students pay the teacher directly, why would we want to consider that being total compensation?
Well, Senator Stumpf, I believe let's see what the outcome of this is, and if it's laid on the table for inclusion, you've done this job enough times to know that there are changes that can be made, whether it's through amendment or discussion, as that omnibus bill is created, and we can certainly deal with that if this goes forward.
Madam Chair, and just in Senator response,
Rosen.
Thank you to Senator Stumpf. The total compensation, and you're looking at the summary, Senator Stumpf, as far as those?
Yes.
The first 12 of that? Okay. And in reply to Senator Bonhoff's question, too, and I appreciate you bringing it back to where it was, I feel like for a lot of school districts with these variables that are much more inconsistent than what we see in the 10-county metro, this is extremely important for the consistency as far as their budgeting and going forward. And I just want to maintain, I'm not going to go through my whole dissertation, Madam Chair, but...
Please don't.
Yeah, we have this.
Yeah. You might diminish its future.
Thank you.
So the motion then is to not include. So if you're voting for it, the motion, it will not be included or considered for inclusion. All right? The secretary will take the roll, or the clerk will take the roll.
Madam Chair? Senator Bonnell?
Yes.
Senator Chamberlain?
No.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator DeKreif?
No.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Harrington?
Excused.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Nelson?
I forgot the double. We're on a double negative here,
yes,
right?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
For possible inclusion, like I would vote opposed. No, so that we can consider this and answer our questions.
Yes. Senator Nino?
No.
Senator Scheid?
Yes.
Senator Stephen?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Torres Ray?
Yes.
Senator Uyghur?
Yes.
Senator Wolf?
Yes. There being six yeses and 10 noes, the motion does not prevail. So we will lay the bill over for further possible further consideration. And
thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Stumpf.
Could have voted no. I don't know what the difference is.
Oh, Smith.
Oh, it's career and technical levies. Okay, good.
Well, it would be no. That motion.
Senator Stumpf, Senate Bill 451, and I will just make a comment that I've heard from several people since the committee hearing that we had with the representatives of the student organizations and the speaker giving a perspective on from a national perspective and on Minnesota for career and technical education that have been very positive. In fact, we've gotten a couple of invitations of the committee would like to make a trip out and see it in action, and we're expressing support or as a need for some additional kinds of we are using tools quite frequently here to allow these programs to continue, thrive, and possibly even grow. So, Senator Stumpf, thank you very much for.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. What I'd like to do, since we're quite short of time, is to have Mr. Schoenfeld kind of lay out a little bit of an explanation and then ask our person who's going to give most of the testimony. But I think basically what we're trying to do, I think, is to figure out a way to bring some very important education back into our school systems. And the component that I think really deals with hands-on learning, technical applied type education, and a few years ago, Mr. Schoenfeld and I worked together and got some provisions in there that worked out very well. And what we'd like to do is expand it, as Madam Chair, as you mentioned. So maybe I think it'd be best if you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Jerry Schoenfeld. I do work with the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators, and did bring to you last week the Dr. Stone, who discussed career and technical education.
Could you move the mic so that we can record your important words?
I would like to make you aware that today, even though that I represent agricultural education, and I'm specific in our presentation to what we have done in that area, these same kinds of things can be more broadly done in other types of career and technical education, and in fact that other types of career and technical education have embedded science standards and so forth in many cases into it. But I am not aware of anybody, probably including science education teachers in the pure sciences, that have actually done what we've done. A few years ago, and I think you have ahead of you the graduation requirements that were handed out, and one of those items there was we had asked the legislature to be able to use agri-science and agricultural economics to basically complement or take the place of elective sciences and economics requirements in the high school. And so after we took that very seriously, and when it was done, we came forward with about where we made requests to individual agribusinesses and so forth, and that's why one of the things you'll see on here, I think, is Christensen Farms, who helped to pay for part of this, and also funding through the MLC, Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council. And we put about $300,000 together, worked about 2 years with our instructors, the Department of Education, and others, and what we've done here is really dealt with showing you how you integrate science education and career and technical education together in the form of agricultural education in this component. And what we did was for years, I guess for about 10 or past 10 years, this committee has dealt with a variety of standards and benchmarks and requirements by the state of Minnesota to require local school districts to meet the standards and benchmarks through the departments of education. We're going to actually show you what standards and benchmarks really are. I think there are some people probably here that are new enough that probably are not totally aware of that, and then show you how it's incorporated into our subject material in a practical way for a teacher in the classroom, and show you how we integrate science into career and technical education, particularly agricultural education. I'll turn it over to Mr. Mike Myron, who is from Forest Lake, and Mike is about a seven-year teacher, I think, at Forest Lake, and has helped us in our association to do this a great deal.
Thank you, Mr. Myron. I think we weren't able to have you testify the other day. Thank you for coming back.
That's correct, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I thank you for having me. I'm excited about this project. And
say your name.
My name is Mike Muron. I teach agriculture education at Forest Lake High School in Forest Lake, Minnesota. And I'm excited to be back with you today because this is certainly something that I'm passionate about and something that I'm using in the classroom, and it does have dramatic results for students. As Mr. Schoenfeld mentioned, you know, when Dr. Stone was here, he talked a great deal about integration and about context for learning. And so what I'm going to do very briefly, knowing that you're already over your committee's meeting time, is try to show you an example of how we're using the CART system in our courses. And I should also note that because of the sponsorship that we've received from Christensen Farms and others, this resource is available to every agriculture teacher throughout the state of Minnesota free of charge. And so not only am I able to find resources for myself, but I'm also able to collaborate with my colleagues throughout the state in designing lessons and assessments so that we don't have to work on an island, that we can work on a broader scale. And the CART system is broken up into several different lesson plan libraries, they're called. And I can certainly sort on subject, but today I'm going to take a little different approach, and I'm going to search by the Minnesota Academic Standards. And so if I click on that particular link, and if the internet here continues to cooperate with me, we were having some technology issues here earlier, and it looks like we may be in the same boat again. I can pull up the different academic standards in the area of language arts, mathematics, and science. And then once I'm able to pull up those standards in science, I'm also able to divide that into, we're able to divide it up into the different substrands in different areas. Let's see if I just go back into the system here, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your patience. We'll see if we can't get this up and running, but if not, I have a couple lessons saved on my hard drive here that I would be able to show you. But as we divided those up, I could look at, for example, the cell strand, and then I can break that strand into several different substrand areas, and then again into the different benchmarks. And when I do that, the CART system will give me access to a variety of different lessons that are available, and one of them that is available to us is about things such as cell division. And so when I go into cell division, it talks about things such as mitosis and how a living creature develops, heals, and so I can pull up that lesson plan based on standard, and it gives me the different areas, the unit, the problem areas, the lessons, and the objectives as they relate back to the Minnesota Academic Standards benchmarks in the area of life sciences. And so when I do that, it gives me an outline of the objectives, the materials that I need, and then that lesson plan is laid out very detailed for me as to what some of the aspects of cell division are, what are the stages of mitosis, and those different things that we can probably relate to back to our biology, especially classes. But MyCart also provides me with a variety of PowerPoint presentations that I can then use to help and aid in the learning for my students. And so the content of the lesson and the standards is then broken into these particular learning approaches and objectives that I can then use to explain what is cell theory and why is mitosis important, and it can guide me through that process and provide me with some content to help in that learning. But what I think is really unique about agriculture education is we also have the opportunity to experience, to help engage students in a real-world activity, to provide them with something that they can see, feel, and touch. And so an example that I use when I teach a cell division unit in my animal science class is to use the context of embryology or the hatching of poultry, chickens, pheasants, something like that. And so we can bring those animals in, we can incubate those eggs, and then through a process of candling, students can actually see that embryo, the fetus, continue to develop and grow inside of the egg, which gives me some context and some application to show how does mitosis, meiosis, and these different processes really work in terms of animals. And then, of course, when that process is over, it lends itself to all kinds of other learning opportunities in terms of, especially if I do pheasants, in terms of growth. And then we also can contact a local state park and sometimes with the Department of Natural Resources and sometimes release those birds. And so we can talk about habitat ecosystems and all different kinds of other life science concepts that we might be able to bring into the classroom. But finally, the other piece that's a part of this as well is all of these lessons have a question bank. And those questions, the quiz questions, are also linked to the Minnesota Academic Standards. So when I'm done teaching the unit, when I'm done teaching the lesson, I can go back to the CART system, and I can design an assessment to measure my students' performance as it relates to the different benchmarks that are located within the academic standards that are set forth.
Thank you very much. Senator Stump?
Madam Chair, what this does is actually fill a void of kind of accomplishes more than one purpose. These are also accepted as college, can be accepted as college credit courses as well. And I believe, Mr. Schoenfeld, you mentioned there was about 7 or 8 programs that have been developed.
Yes.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chairman, we have about 7 or 8 curriculum that were here. And unfortunately, Madam Chairman, I'm sorry, what was shown to you just now was what he had on his computer itself. Normally, for whatever reason, your Wi-Fi system isn't working here and you're not getting into the Internet.
I haven't.
In any case, it goes in much more depth than what was shown here, and you would have been able to see how you match up all of those. Perhaps you can play with it while I'm talking a little bit. But in any case, yes, we also in agriculture, we have several people that have been certified for college in the schools, so University of Minnesota, so that we've got courses that are both high school agri-science credits and, in fact, also in the plant science areas and the animal science areas, also provide college credit at the University of Minnesota. But there are 7 different areas, and only those 2 that I've just mentioned are those that are the college and schools. But all the other areas meet for elective sciences, for agricultural sciences. Unfortunately, when we came to the legislature a few years ago and we asked for this, it was granted. But one of the things that you'll see ahead of you as you look at all the graduation requirements and the revised standards and so forth is the fact that each year it seems we've added more requirements. And we've added, for instance, algebra true that must be in the year 2014, and then physics or chemistry in the year 2014 as well. What that has done is just eaten up the hours of the day, particularly when school districts have gone, in many cases, down to 5 or 6 hour days in order to save money. And what it has done is really pushed our elective science out. And so what we're coming here and pointing out to you, I guess when Dr. Stone talked to you last week, he talked about the fact, in large cases, that we were seeing graduation, the number of graduates, percentage of graduates were diminishing. In many cases across the country, as students became less able to handle some of the increased graduation requirements. And what we're trying to do is make this come more alive for students so that they get the science and so forth along with the career and technical education and make those not only pure science but also practical applications. And so that's what the bill does in part. It changes it so that in one section that it deals with where it changes the revised requirements to say that it could be chemistry, physics, or a CTE course, and it's in the science section, so it's a science-based CTE course.
Senator Stump, and I think on page two of the bill, you see the change as it relates to science, and I think there's at least one more where career and technical education is in current law, but I think the idea is to there may be more options here too, but this shows I think that the level of cross referencing of the standards in terms of the curriculum that's being taught in various ways, and this opens that door for career and technical education in whatever areas that these concepts and these standards are being taught will be recognized.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Nelson, I think, was the first one on the list, and I saw a couple more hands here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Marin, it sounds like a great curriculum, a great class, and I think we're on the right track when we look at increasing science courses and options for our students. So I think that is a great thing. I just need a little bit of clarification, and I'm not exactly sure if it would come from you or from our fiscal analyst, but I'm trying to understand how just allowing a science course to be included in this CTE would actually, there's two places on our fiscal note where it says that this would grant significant new taxing authority to the local school boards, and so I'm wondering about that. And then it's page two, actually, is what I see here. And then at the bottom it says the proposed changes would increase property taxes authority for local school districts. And so I'm wondering, I just need some clarification on the increasing local property taxes, and do the residents have any say about that? And why are we increasing taxes just by allowing a science course?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, first of all, the current career and technical program funding is all levied, and it's all discretionary for the local boards to opt into the program. Mr. Schoenfeld, there is also, Madam Chair,
you have an amendment that you would like
the
to.
The amendment, too, that should really be on there so that on page
three. Should you distribute the amendment? Mr. Schoenfeld, you want to describe the amendment's being passed?
Madam Chair, the amendment would be on page three, on line 3.4. And what it would be to strike the new language on 3.4 and also the new language on 3.5 up until the word program is done, and then to reinstate the old language, which is average daily membership. And the reason for that change, Madam Chair, is that when we first looked at this bill, we thought that we could more clearly tie it to the career and technical, the levy to the career and technical students but found that that was a little bit more difficult than we thought it was. And so it's been suggested to go back to what we've been used to, which is in the existing law of average daily membership. So
you'd like to move that amendment?
Madam Chair, I'd move that A1 amendment.
A1 amendment. This is an author's amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
And then, Madam Chairman, if
the motion prevails.
I'm sorry, Madam Chairman. If you'd like, I could speak to Senator Nelson's question.
Madam Chair, my question just is then with this amendment in place, will the fiscal note about increasing property taxes no longer be applicable?
No, it will be.
It still will be. So then I do need an answer to my question.
All right, thank you. Senator Nelson, this does have a property tax impact because it is increasing some funding, and that's the objective. It will be contingent on what we do in the creation of the bill. We may well have some levy available through other decisions that could allow this to go forward without having an overall property tax impact. That's what we'll be working toward.
Oh, so is the idea to lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill based upon all those things?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
You don't need to answer my question then. Thank you.
There were a couple other hands here. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fully supportive. I have one area for potential exploration. In addition to the career tech ed credit in lieu of physics, chemistry, so that it aligns to what's relevant, what about the Algebra 2 requirement and something that might align to the career-ready objective? We talk college career-ready. That's the bottom line that gets us to the end zone. That's how we declare success. If they're in this program, do we need to be as concerned about Algebra 2 proficiency or something that gets them to that program? And because as we're going to look at the amendment here for physics, chemistry, maybe there's something on Algebra 2 as well.
Madam Chairman, Senator Wieger, this bill does not address that.
Correct.
There is, as I said, another requirement in 2014 for Algebra 2, and that will stay intact.
Madam Chair, is consistent with and I'm thinking of our expert speaker that came in and talking about whether some of these standards are not aligned to the expectation of the job market. And so I know what the bill states, but could it be improved?
Madam Chair, we believe it could be improved. But what we have done, at least from our end, is work towards the science application and the economics application. And we have done that in both cases. We have not taken the economics quite as far, although we've been working with the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Council for Economic Education, and we've worked with them in that area. But in terms of mathematics, if you get into the MyCart situation here that we're looking at, there are areas that do align to the math standards, chemistry, physics, and all those kinds of things that do align, but not as extensively as they do in the science area, so that's why we dealt with it in the bill.
And Senator Wieger, I think in that presentation, there are some areas, and he's addressing agriculture education, but many in some of the trades, such as machine trades, actually have a heavier students that take a machine trades program often perform far better on algebra, particularly in math areas, than the ones who've taken it in a regular course. So that was part of that presentation and some evidence to that. And we haven't dealt with all of that, but I think we're trying to, number one, keep this connection alive and this option so that we can continue to help people understand and be educated to the fact that there's more than one way to learn and learn well in some of the academic standards.
Well, I'm tracking with you.
I'm just
suggesting in the math there might be the same application, and we'll just ask as it further brews that we look at it.
Madam Chair, I did pull up the math academic standard as you were visiting, and these were some lessons that were aligned to the academic standards in the area of math computation. And so here are some examples of veterinary math, applying fertilizers, some different types of math applications that are also available and aligned in the MyCart system.
And Madam Chair, we're out of time, but yes. There's an excellent report. I just got it. It's where we pay dues to the Education Commission of States. You and I are both members. They just came out with an excellent report that I think I just sent you, Sandra Stumpf, but it talks about 1 in 4 students being directly impacted in the trend, and we're on the right direction. And maybe we can further review that.
Good. Thank you very much, Senator Wieger. If there are no other last words, do you all get the point, and we can lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill? And then before we adjourn, we are scheduled for a meeting tomorrow. We will be dealing primarily with the integration aid issue. And it may be a long one. We are going to try to, you know, we're coming up to crunch time, so we may have to be putting in a little bit of time. Yes. Senator Daley?
Madam Chair, the time for that tomorrow?
Is at 3 o'clock.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're room change. We're going to be in room 112. Could we just have one more thing? Some of us have been getting calls from people that have students in the Blue Sky Virtual School. Thank you, folks.
Thank you very much.
And that is being threatened to be closed, and they're concerned. I know I had some parents concerned where their daughter, who is somewhat fragile, has just a couple courses left and would be graduating in May. And if it's going to be closed on March 21st, they're trying to figure out what's going on. Can you give us a little clarification on what's happening with the Blue Sky Virtual Academy for our understanding and response to the contacts we have received?
Sure.
Mr. Shackleton.
Brian Shackleton, Minnesota Department of Education. I cannot. But I'd like to get to the point. I cannot, but tomorrow we can have Rose Hermanson, who's one of our assistant commissioners, and David Hartman, who does work with charter schools, to come. This is a legal issue, obviously, and they've sent out a letter, and so they'll define kind of the parameters around how they can answer the question. But we'll have them come tomorrow if that's okay.
But hopefully we'll be able to answer to people and I don't know what kind of accommodations. I know there's issues around whether the school is being responsive to the concerns and shouldn't be closed, or, you know, there's that issue. But there's others that are saying if it is it just a slice off on March 21st, or is it going to be allowed 30 to 60 days so that those students that are close to finishing could finish? So I would appreciate some response relative to that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.